I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, Emil Dreitzer is the author of In the Jaws of the Crocodile, a Soviet memoir which recounts his experiences as a satirist in the Soviet Union. He joins us on this edition of the program to discuss what satire meant in the Soviet Union, as well as to talk about his experiences as an Odessa-born Jew who had to contend with some of the anti-Semitism found in the Soviet Union during his life there. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views, and now on to the conversation with Emil Dreitzer, author of In the Jaws of the Crocodile, a Soviet memoir. Welcome to Parallax Views, Emil Dreitzer, author of the new book, In the Jaws of the Crocodile, a Soviet memoir. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
So, Emil, I guess the first place I want to start with looking at this new book you've written is it's sort of a sequel and a prequel at once. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about how it acts as both a sequel and a prequel to other books you've written?
Okay. It just happened to be, I never designed it that way, but back in 2008, University of California Press published my memoir titled Shush, Growing Up Jewish Under Stalin, which covers, I was born shortly before World War II started, before World War II started. And so it covers my wartime experiences as a child, and most importantly, the time of the high Stalinism, of the doctor's plot, and it ends with a few months after the death of Stalin with celebration of our Jewish family of the event. And I describe it all. And then I wrote, actually last year, I published this autobiographical novel, Farewell Mama Odessa, because I was born and raised in Odessa and considered myself Odessan. It definitely played a major role in my life. So this is autobiographical novel, and probably I would say in full sense, because basically nothing in it is invented, although it's called novel. The only thing I invented is that the alter ego, the main character, my personal story, I broke up in two. Imagine that for the young one, the same thing, journalist, satirist leaves Russia and goes through immigration. And he receives a letter from his cousin, which is obviously a split of my whole personality, who has already lived a few years in America. So his first impression of America, first thing that strike him is so unusual that he has to write to his cousin about it. So in other words, it's totally autobiographical as well. And then just this year, in January, University of Wisconsin Press published this book, In the Jaws of Crocodile, in which I describe, actually, I start really literally 2 months after the end of the Shush in the summer of 1953. This is actually September 1953, in conversation with my literary teacher, who gave me the first impetus, so to speak, some encouragement to write. And so that's how the whole thing, the whole trilogy came about.
If we could, you mentioned the doctor's plot, which I guess in brief for my listeners was basically this really anti-Semitic campaign that Stalin organized, in which these Jewish doctors were accused of a conspiracy to assassinate Soviet leaders. This leads to a lot of anti-Semitism in Russia, or maybe it just maybe it didn't even start with that, but it exacerbated it. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, I wanted to just remind listeners that the country in which the ill-reputed Protocols of Zion Elders was produced was Russia. In the beginning of 20th century, it was produced strictly to encourage pogroms against Jews, to support the Tsarist position, and so on. So that's not totally new. In other words, Doctor's Blood is just one of the last kind of, needless to say, during the Civil War in 1918 and 1919 and so on, there was a tremendous amount during Civil War of pogroms of Jews all over the Pale of Settlement, the area in which they prescribed to live under the Tsarist rule. So this is nothing totally new. But officially, with the start of the Soviet system, the internationalism called for at least announcement of equality of all nations under the law and the rest of it. And it was definitely the grassroots anti-Semitism in Russia never died totally. But it was, at least, was never surfaced. It was never in public policy. But with Stalin's, at the end of Stalin's life, 1952, with the arrest of Doctor's Blood, that was the beginning of the campaign to actually, from what I know, the research today shows that the plan was to bring this group of Kremlin doctors accused of trying to poison the leaders of the country to trial, obviously to convict them, and then it would be called to mass displacement of Jewish population from European part of the country into Siberia and some other areas, which obviously would be detrimental to their survival. So that was the Doctor's Blood. That's why it's stuck in history as being. Luckily, Stalin's death prevented from this plot, this whole idea to fruition. And shortly after, they were. Those who came to replace Stalin understood that it just goes too far and will damage the, especially after Holocaust, it will damage the international standing of Soviet Union, and the doctors were released.
I just wanted to add to that. I think it's important that you brought up the protocols because, you know, there's obviously a deep-rooted sort of cultural issue there with anti-Semitism in Russia. And even when the czars are overthrown and the Soviet Union is formed, it doesn't mean that all these deep-rooted cultural issues go away, which leads me to ask you, what was it like growing up in the midst of some of this anti-Semitism in your homeland?
Well, when I was growing up as a child, I recall very well. I describe in Shush one of the scenes when I, as a child, I couldn't understand it, why my mother will stay in long lines for food all the time, at that time especially. And so my mother would, every time they would say, oh, they always try to take advantage, somebody says, and so. And my mother, although it would be pronounced they, but it was clearly understood, this is who are they, that this is Jews. So she really grabbed me and held me and so on, because she felt this is a threat, there's something. One more word and something will start. So that definitely, and with the doctor's plot, actually, what the immediate aftermath was that my mother's closest friend, she was a pediatrician. And she came, I'll never forget this scene, she came to my mother crying that her patients refused to bring their children to her because they're afraid that she will poison them. And she cried and told my mother that she's so upset, hurt professionally, because she, as a pediatrician, loved her little patients. And now the accusation that she will hurt, simply insult her so deeply. And she lost her job, but she lost kind of faith in humanity, if you wish.
When did you first become aware of anti-Semitism? Because early in the memoir, I think you maybe feel like everything is on you. You've sort of really assimilated to some of the things you've heard in media and the education system. So if there's a problem, it sounds like you immediately put it upon yourself to say, well, it's my fault. But it seems like this anti-Semitism also ends up being a roadblock, and your mother notices it maybe a bit earlier than you do.
Well, first, to begin with, as soon as I finished my high school, the question will be a very, very important question to get into a college. And that was at that time, we are talking about the years of 1955, although Stalin died, but it's only, but his spirit did not die immediately. As we know, that the speech of Khrushchev was the next year, and the spirit in the system itself did not die completely for a long time. So here's what's the problem. She already told me that she asked me, and I described it in my opening scene, when I told her my teacher wants me to have a literary education because she felt I have some abilities and so on. She says, no way. Are you kidding? No way. You'll get engineering degree in some engineering institution. But to get there at that time was, despite the high mark, whatever I had a good grades all the way through for all 10 years. It was very, very difficult because it was so clear that you'll be discriminated on this particular. Obviously, nobody will tell you this, but they would fail you. They'll find one way or another. There are many different means, and I described in the book how to do it.
I just wanted to add to that. It seems like the discrimination wasn't always necessarily really overt or in your face. It was sort of done in a, like, maybe more subtle or covert way.
Absolutely. It was never in your face. It was never told that this is because you're Jewish. Absolutely not. They would simply fail you. They, let's say, during exam, they may ask you, we usually prepare, we had a set of questions that we have to be prepared in order to be sure that we know our material. And they will ask you some, or they give you solve some mathematical problem that usually requires, let's say, 5 minutes to solve, but they will give you 1 minute. So in other words, to find a way to fail you. And I describe also in the book of stories of my immediate cousins and who also tried to, same thing, they would know everything, but then again, they will ask questions which professionals may not want answer. But it was enough reason. It was never a word that because you're Jewish was said. No, you simply didn't pass. That's it.
And could you also talk a little bit more for my listeners about what it's like growing up in Odessa and what the culture is like? Because I'm assuming it may be very different from Moscow, where you end up later in the memoir.
Absolutely. Well, Odessa was a traditionally a center of Jewish culture. There were Jews in other cities, but not to that extent, because Odessa was built, basically how Jews wind up to be in Odessa to begin with, is that Odessa was founded at the end of 18th century by Catherine the Great to have a port that with warm water that will be possible to have trade with Europe, specifically with grain. And she invited Jews from the Pale of Settlement, the area in which they were prescribed to live, to come over and help. And they came. And it was for them, it was actually, there was at that time, I found there was a saying, oh, he lives like God in Odessa, because there was so much more freedom they had in their activities, culture. Odessa was the center of Jewish theater in of the time. Moreover, very few people know that actually the daughter of two Odessa actors opened a school in America when she immigrated. And I think, I forgot her name. And she, the famous school. So in other words, Odessa was a very, very Jewish. To the beginning, the actual statistics showed that the end of 19th century, one third of the population of Odessa were Jewish. Obviously, synagogues, obviously, all cultural centers, societies, and so on. Sholem Aleichem lived in Odessa. And Jewish poet Bialik lived in Odessa. Jabotinsky from Odessa. The father of Boris Pasternak, the famous Russian poet, Leonid Pasternak was from Odessa, and on and on and on. So that created certain, to the degree that in my time, actually not even my time, I describe it in I think in Shush, that I saw Soviet movies of wartime, and then the character, instead of being anti-Semitic, they wouldn't say, oh, you Jews. They would say, oh, you Odessans, you're good for nothing. You understand? That would be the word that replaced, actually, replaced the word Jew. It was clear, if Odessan. So, but in the same time, Odessa was even to, well, actually, the even before the all the period before the beginning of World War II, even at some courts used Yiddish in their proceedings because there were so many Jews were there. Some schools of Yiddish language, I mean, they taught and so on. Everything ended after the war. None of it, even close. It was when my time, when I was growing up as a child, only one synagogue of the huge city, and it was just placed all way all outside. I describe it in the book, how you have to go to Peresit, to God knows where, early morning to get there, or you to get matzah for the holiday. You have to go to that one bakery out. You have to bring your own flour and pay them, and they will bake it for you. There was not available, nothing like that in the store, because it was considered to be the bourgeois nationalism is coming with Jewish culture.
I wanted to delve into that more. It seems like there is a sort of class structure that you even see with your time in the Soviet Union, that, you know, there are working class people, there are sort of these sort of elites who get away with things within Soviet society. Not everything is as equal as maybe the state-run media would have people believe. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, of course. Russia was a highly stratified society. Stratification was on many, many levels. A few people kind of realized that basically all this talk about, let's say, equality of the, there was nothing close to that. The power in the country belonged to a small group of called nomenklatura, means higher echelons of managers and party, high party officials, who dictated the policy, who were the rest were kind of combined. But still, at the same time, let's say working class, to which my father belonged, was by far would never be able to mingle, let's say, with people of, let's say, in academia or any, it was considered to be totally no-no. So by all means, it was not a society we called. Needless to say that the peasants basically was kept in the collector farms, almost like during the serfdom. A few people realize, even I tell my students when I teach Russian cinema at Hunter College, realize that you could not, if you're a peasant, if you could not live in this city without permission of police. And everybody in Soviet Union had a passport, internal passport. You have to carry on you like driver's license in America if you drive, right? And it says where you live, okay?
One part that really stuck out for me in the early portion of the book was you talk about how much you want to go to university, and you sort of have a rivalry with another student who's also trying to get the highest marks. And it seems like he has this advantage because his family is more on the in crowd when it comes to the Soviet Union. And it actually makes me think of similarities with U.S. culture, because, I mean, some kids have a leg up because of the family they're born into, their legacy at institutions like Harvard or whatnot. It seems like there's similarities between America and Russia.
Absolutely. In my case, that what I described in the book, yes, the fellow, actually, we were in good relationship. It had nothing to do between us. But his father was a high official of the local, one of the local management of the seaport. His mother had connections with some people in power. And obviously, when they had to decide who to give a gold medal, because the gold medal was the passport for going to college without exams. That's why it was so coveted. It's not so much of the value itself. So it was clear, obviously, the choice was clear. Who would get the absolutely. In this case, it's the same story.
Did you see any, when you first came to America, I'm just curious, did you see any similarities with experiences you had growing up in Russia? And I, of course, you would have also experienced a lot of differences too. But I really wanted to pick your brain about that because it seems like, you know, we're all sort of human and a lot of us have very similar experiences.
Yeah, actually, I have to say, if from what really stands out of my first impression of America, what really, frankly, shocked me is when back in Soviet Union, we all tried to, we means the young people who wanted to see exposure, wanted to see the world outside of Russia. We listened and enjoyed very much jazz. And Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald were our gods, okay? So when we came to America and found actually from the history, there's, you know, black performers of high fame still in back in the 30s, 40s, even 50s could not get in the same hotel, it blew my mind. I could not understand it. You know, this I could not fathom. Okay, please understand me rightly. Russia is also a racist country. There's no question about it. First of all, obviously, anti-Semitism, grassroots, never disappeared. In Soviet time, they would call all Asian people chuchmek, which is a made-up word that comes from Asian culture, which was Uzbek and Tatar, whatever it is, okay? Obviously, not official policy at all, but it would be in the society itself existed then, didn't go. And I understand that this is some deficiency of us, of human species, the inability to overcome and create stereotypes and so on and so forth. But as I say again, when I came to America, the racism really blew my mind. This I could not accept. Even, you know, when we talk about today, the recent attacks on Asian America and so on, it still hurt. You understand, America is the country I chose. And I love America, and I'm definitely benefit of coming here. But it hurts because, you know, after all, I know what does it mean to be, you know, to be different, to be treated not like everybody else, and so on. Yeah.
I think the other interesting aspect of maybe when I talk about similarities, I think humans have certain shared experiences. We have certain struggles. And one of the things I love about this memoir is you don't have to be someone who lived through the Soviet Union to understand the struggle of a family that is having trouble just making ends meet or trying to get food. You don't have to be from the Soviet Union to understand someone who has a passion and wants to become a writer. And I really wanted to get your comment on that. There seems to be a shared humanity that comes out in this book.
Yeah, that's true. That no matter where you are as a child, let's say as a youngster, what I think it's a generational kind of a young generation needs not to repeat the life of their parents. They want to overcome it or wanted to do something more of themselves than simply replicate their parent. That's why I felt. So for me was once the teacher told me that you have some literary abilities, I wanted to develop it. Obviously, I was looking any ways to get. Besides something about literature, something that has to be understood by literature, because unlike in America, where at least a lot of literature is considered to be just entertainment, nothing like that. In Russia, literature occupies a special place traditionally, starting from 18th century, 19th century. It was almost like priesthood. A writer, you see the word, I remember myself, like how easily people say in America, oh, I'm a writer. No matter what, you know, back in my Russia, I had a literary experience, I would not brag about, but over 150 pieces I published in top literary journals and so on. But I would never dare to call myself a writer besides it. because Pisatel is a special, it means you have to be author of a book that has some significance, some, in other words, otherwise you're a scribbler. You're, it's nothing to talk about. So from that standpoint of view, of course, it's the desire of young generation to overcome their their destiny, so to speak, by doing something not like their parents. It's probably endemic, you know, in every generation.
I really like the portion, too, where you talk about a younger version of yourself being a big fan of Martin Eden, the Jack London novel, and sort of relating to the idea of a young proletariat worker that wants to become a writer and woo the girl at the end. It's very touching in a way.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, when I read Martin Eden, I said to myself, wow, I also come from a working class family. And look at this, Martin Eden make it, you know, put all his hope on, you know, being a writer and published and so on and so forth. That would be, and I also thought that was encouragement, obviously inspiration for me. Of course, I didn't have that much of experience that he had, but I know like Jack London had that I could put in my book. And that partially is why I turned to, when opportunity came, to writing satire, because it was not so much of reflection of my experience as my attitude toward things that are going around. And I found a niche in which I could say, I could, so to speak, not to lie, and didn't lie, because I wrote only about negative things that I saw. And at the same time, that was permitted in the Soviet Union of my time to attack and press.
It's interesting to me that you mentioned Soviet satire. And I think at the beginning of the book, actually, you mention a relative or a family member saying, wait, Soviet satire, that's a thing? Maybe explain, what is Soviet satire? Because I think it raises an eyebrow when people hear that. They think, isn't that a contradiction? What is that?
Right, contradiction in terms, actually, my son was 1.5 years old when he came to America. So he's basically American. So he, when he read my book, he said, I don't understand it. So, well, okay, the point is that obviously the question is probably legitimate, like Soviet satire, what is it? What is this about? And the thing is that, yeah, when we think of totalitarian country, we think, why do we need satire if they have everything under control? But the point is, there are certain things that are too much to have control on every aspect of what's going on. It's just not manageable. So the only solution is to create a moral climate of that this kind of things are not permissible, they're hurtful, and so on and so forth. So the magazine Crocodile, that was actually was produced back in 1920s, with this particular test already, like bureaucratism, for example. We have to remind that the bureaucratic apparatus of, especially the first decade of Soviet Union, was a Tsarist apparatus, because they invited so many people who knew how to run a country, how to run things and so on. So in other words, bureaucracy, needless to say, is endemic to probably every society. It's just in part of human brain, not capable of let's say, working through every detail. They have certain kind of partition for everything. So the crocodile was actually brought in order to be this beast that could eat all the shortcomings. But what was important is to set out right away that, yes, we need, the satire is needed, but whatever shortcomings exist in Soviet life, at least for the exposure on the pages of the magazine, is not systemic. It just because certain people don't have enough consciousness, socialist consciousness, to do their job correctly. They fall back on so-called remnants of capitalism in people's consciousness. That's I quote. That was how it worked. So it was this kind of a niche was created. And it probably would be interesting to see what kind of things actually were open to public criticism in Crocodile and some other newspapers around the country published feuilleton, they call it, satirical columns. So, for example, rank and file employees would be criticized for poor work discipline, taking too long, smoke breaks and things like that, poor workmanship, because I have to remind you, people were paid very little, so there was not much of an interest to work just for the salary. It doesn't matter how you would not get more salary from if you're not on a certain standard produced. Theft at workplace. And I still remember this big cover of Crocodile magazine, and young man is taking out tires from the place and says, well, after all, isn't everything belongs to the working people in this country? Things like that. So making fun of this. Not only that, then and law and middle-level management as well. Bureaucracy, for example, again, merry-go-round, so bribery that existed, of course.
I was going to mention real quick, I think you even write in the memoir about one case you covered in a feuilleton about embezzling of public funds. So that's another similarity. I think you see these things in the U.S. and Soviet Union. Yeah.
Human beings are human beings. I say all the faults, what I'm talking about, obviously they're not only particular to the Soviet Union, obviously they are everywhere, but there's different ways of handling it, right? In many ways, it was part of it, it was probably impossible because it was so prevalent. The people hardly look at the end of my Soviet period of my life, right? I had a full-time job as an editor in the technical publish house. Plus, I published as a freelancer in all the major newspapers and magazines and so on as a satirical writer. My wife at that time was also worked as a assistant. Two of our salaries, and we had that one child produced, two of our salaries was barely enough to make it to the next paycheck, just food. I'm not talking about anything else. Okay, so that just shows that kind of a, and we had nothing to steal. I don't know what temptation we would have, nothing, okay? So what I'm saying, it was a lot of things like people in, let's say, in, if it's a manager, he wants to get a bonus. To has to cook books in order to get one. Same thing, right? Cooking books, it's not invented the expression American, but it's existed in Soviet Union as well. Abuse of power of the office as well. Again, we're not talking about high office. We're talking about a manager of some small factory, not only even a big manager, but a small manager. They would any rudeness, and I would even published a few articles about the rudeness of the high-handedness of it, again, small managers. But it was suppressing criticism. Any antisocial behavior, of course, for the general population, drunkenness and so on. So in other words, plenty of object that I, as a satirist, could with my full consciousness criticize, knowing that I'm not saying that the rest is wonderful, but at least that's the niche I found from my own writing.
So in regards to your career as a satirist in the Soviet Union, what do you consider maybe your biggest successes? And what was the maybe turning point in your career as a satirist?
Yes, it's a good question because I would probably not wake up. Remember, I was a child of the Thaw. That means the culture that the change in the more permissive, more open culture after Khrushchev's speech about Stalin's crimes against humanity in 1956. So at least for another let's say several years, things became different. Many things open up for open criticism, obviously not the system itself, but abuses that could be managed at least on some local level. So, and it just happened that I, and I, as a young man, I was at that time only in my early 20s, I was part of that, we call it generation of the 60s, 60-setniki, it's called in Russian, to which belong many, many prominent, famous writers and young writers and young musicians, young artists. But it came to a point in which I thought that at least what is bad, it could be criticized. And I traveled during one of my travels, I saw a play in a provincial theater, and I wrote a skating satire about it. And the Crocodile magazine, who already published me for few years, published it, a huge kind of a spread of this piece. Needless to say, they read it. Needless to say, they checked out and so on. But what really happened is that from the time of they accepted the piece for publication, the time when it was printed, it passed like, I think, a couple of months. And that in that interim period, the author of the play became a very important official who could not be criticized. In other words, there was some, I always said, I wish we had like who in the West, we know who is this person. Nobody knew. As a result, it was a huge scandal, and the Minister of Culture, Furtseva, was enraged, and she needed ask for blood. And the blood was shed. Of course, I was a freelancer, and I was saying, we no longer will use you, and so on and so forth. But I was lucky, because by that time, now we're talking about 1971, things start changing in the Soviet Union on the cultural front. There was some kind of I wouldn't say underground, hidden resistance to the system, making fun of her, proliferation of underground jokes. And the most importantly, the Literary Gazette start publishing on the surface humor, but with Aesopian satire pitched in. And I found niche there for myself. I started also writing things that are on the surface. For example, I published a piece which looks like a scene, you know, a street scene everybody can recognize. It's a line of people standing on the street for a hot day and drink kvass. And kvass, as you know, it's a fermented drink. It's like as popular as a Coca-Cola in America. So they will. And they come to a point where the vendor says, "Okay, no longer it's ended. Don't make any lines anymore." And people start saying, "How come? We are thirsty." And somebody suggested, "Listen, in order for this kvass to be for everybody, why wouldn't you add some water? Some water." So he says, "Well, it's okay." So he added water. So in time, it was only pure water, and they paid for kvass, okay? And when it came to the point, and the inspector came of quality, and he said, "What's going on?" He said, "Well, listen, that's what happened, and so on. No, well, important that you give it everybody in equal terms. This is important. The equality is important. In other words, people accept their poverty as long as it's equal, everybody's poverty." You see, that kind of a satire, again, that kind of a thinking. So it was published after another half a dozen of my work appeared there. But then at one point, I decided, I saw that eventually it's only like, we call it kukish kvermani, means we call it like showing a finger in your pocket. In other words, I know that I'm making fun of the government system. You know, the reader, but they don't care. In other words, they don't see it. They probably saw it, of course, but they make believe that they don't understand it.
So basically, not to interrupt you, I apologize. I was going to say, so basically, you're sort of writing in between the lines, so to speak, and your readers are reading in between the lines.
Exactly. Readership. Why? Because the readership was not by chance, by Literary Gazette, which is usually for kind of highly educated, I mean, literary minded, it was huge. It's million copies were sold around the country, and it became very popular. People start reading it from the club 12 chairs. I describe it in my best memoir, how it all came about. But that was a result, actually, of a waking up after invasion of Czechoslovakia. This all started after Soviet troops suppressed Czechs' attempt to create socialism with human face. That began this kind of a resistance, cultural resistance, counterculture, if you wish. But again, it was between the lines. So for me, then it was that was the option. I realized that I'm, you know, I don't want to write for this showing finger in your pocket, right? But my next step that was interesting for me, that I came to my Jewishness without suspecting it. I thought of it, okay, I would stop writing that kind of things. Why wouldn't I just write regular stories? Regular. And I wrote a small story and about simple human kind of it's a monologue of a old man who talks to younger about his life, how it all came up. Anyway, when I brought this story to a journal who already published me, the editor read it and said to me, I'm sorry, I love this story. It's sad and funny at the same time, but we cannot publish it. Why? Because it's Jewish. I say, why? What's Jewish about it? There is no Jewish name. There is nothing of Judaism, nothing Karelian. But I came to realize later on, in this and other stories, that actually the attitude, the Jewish culture was inside of it. I mean, it means the attitude, the relationship between people in Russia, the Russian Jewish kind of a culture is starkly different from the way the Russian culture around it, in that kind of a sense of how people relate to each other. Okay. So therefore, well, I'll give you just one, maybe it's not a crass example, but I remember that as a boy growing up, some Russian neighbors, they had a wedding. And during the wedding, there were some fights started and somebody beat up somebody. And I was horrified, of course, because it did not by all means click with Jewish wedding that I attended. Nothing like that, even close. But they took it in stride. Okay, what kind of, we got drunk, da-da-da-da. I'm just giving you one small example of it. But so, in other words, the relationship within the group is still pretty much, as I understood much later on, it goes to the core of the Judaism. Treat other people like you want to treat yourself, period. Okay? But it's, again, very Jewish concept that is definitely not recognizable as such outside. That's what happened.
What's interesting about what you said concerning this sort of whole underground sort of press that used satire, I think we see the same thing here in the U.S. In the 1960s and 70s with publications like The Realist, Paul Krasner. It seems like satire across the world has the ability to speak some types of truth that you can't always say in a serious tone. You may get in trouble for it, or maybe it's just easier to say things in a satirical form. What do you think the power of satire is, though?
Well, I think that you're right. It has entertaining side to it. So in other words, altogether humor. I'm talking about funny satire. You see, there is a difference. I learned it in America, because when I the country I came from, the culture, Russian culture, satire usually it's funny. Not necessarily it is true in the West. 1984 is satire, but it's not funny. Going back to the Brave New World is not funny and so on. But in Russia, it was always, you make fun of it. You make fun of it, and therefore it became a little bit more palatable. The greatest satire, actually my dissertation in America that I wrote and published as a Techniques of Satire, is based on Saltykov-Shchedrin, what was the biggest Russian satirist of the 19th century after Gogol. So his satire, when satire that he wrote about the in his time, about, and he himself was high official, by the way, interesting enough, vice governor of one of the Russian provinces. It was so recognizable because basically he touched upon some shortcomings of the Russian national character that actually brings, almost invites this absolute power abuses of people and so on and so forth. So, yes, so the the humor adds to attractiveness of it. You laugh at it, at least. You know, you make it satirical, you laugh at it. It's more acceptable than you say up front something like that. But I don't know. I have actually, when I was thinking about it, I came to the conclusion that probably laughter has another quality of it. It somehow makes, if not peace, but kind of ameliorates the effect of satirical attack. So it is hard. I'm not sure that to what extent it's really working at all. But we liked Art Buchholz. We read a lot of Art Buchholz was reprinted in Soviet time in Soviet newspapers for obvious reasons. He make fun of the Washington, of White House, and all of this business, and it was funny at the same time.
Well, it's interesting because I think that there's this sort of pop culture vision of everything is just censored in the Soviet Union. I think a lot of people have that idea. At the same time, it doesn't seem that simple. It does seem like there's censorship, but it's not necessarily the way America viewed it in a sort of pop culture lens.
Yeah. Oh, okay. As far as the censorship in the Soviet time, as I already mentioned, all faults of socialist economy have to be shown as being local and sporadic, not systemic. Also, no party apparatus to be criticized by any paper but Pravda, because it's a central paper for the Politburo and so on. Now, no criticism of Soviet foreign press you would see in any Soviet paper, or foreign policy, I'm sorry, the criticism of Soviet foreign policy. You cannot say, no, it's the wrong thing that we went to Afghanistan, whatever it is, no way. And so in some territorial blockages, simply because of the who you know. In other words, Brezhnev close friends in high party apparatus, if they were officially responsible of certain territory, you could not write anything about critical about this particular, you know, territory. It was definitely prohibited. So, and there was actually it's now, of course, now it's available in press, a booklet of the Glavlit. This is the Central Censorship Bureau in Soviet Union, which has lists of things you cannot mention in every sphere, not only in military, in industrial. For example, the amount of industrial accidents, how many people were injured, whether you cannot. In other words, there are a number of really truly important things were blocked by censors.
So in regards to how you end up emigrating to the U.S., I wanted to get to that at least briefly. How do you end up emigrating to the USA, and could you talk about your blacklisting in the Soviet Union?
In the Soviet Union, as I say, I was blacklisted in a crocodile as an author, and I could not be in any other press. But at that time, as I mentioned already, Literary Gazette was the only place that sort of almost said, we are not party organs. We are instrument, right? We are just literary. So this is fun. You're writing something that's a funny story about, let's say, drinking kvass or some other things and so on. So in other words, it was possible. It was not like I was totally blackout. Also, but it became, as I already explained, became unsatisfying for me as a writer. That eventually I thought. So after I was, my story that the editor found Jewish, although it was not Jewish in it, as I explained, I realized that actually I have no place for myself as such in that time, luckily to my luck, was the movement, the Soviet Jewry movement in America. And that really made a big difference. Then at least I felt I was still not too old. I was only 36, 37. I decided to come to America. It was not easy. The decision was always, and that was on purpose, done. When you apply for immigration at that time, you never know you'll be permitted or not. But if you're not permitted, you're finished. In other words, they know that you're politically unreliable, period. So no job of any sense of responsibility will be given to you. You may have to be driving cars or something of that sort. That's about it. So I was lucky.
And I wanted to ask, because I should have asked earlier, you initially had doubts about doing satire initially, correct?
Correct, yeah. And it came actually in the chapter that I described in the book, How to Win Them Over. My doubts were only on one ground. I knew that what I'm doing is not against my conscience, but my parents were, all of them, my parents, my all relatives, they live in a world which is totally, let's say, anti-Soviet. In what sense? They did not believe any word of the official pronouncement. They didn't believe Khrushchev, that he's doing it for his own some purpose and so on. They didn't believe things will change ever. So they tried to stay in a safe zone and so on. So therefore, when I was starting to write, I was thinking, and that I described, for example, why my parents would be against me making fun of how poor of the poor quality of clothing for babies. That's one first assignment that the editor gave me, a letter from a woman who complained that when she came to, she asked for to buy some onesies for her newborn baby. And the salesman said, is your baby choleric or sanguinic? Is he lively baby or not? I say, what has to do with it? Well, we have only for quiet babies, because if he starts moving his legs and will fall apart immediately and so on. Just making fun of it. So I thought, why would they be against this? You know, but for them, the only fact still why I had this birth, that I write that I kind of a take side of the, I'm not an official, of course, but I am in Soviet press. In other words, I'm on the side of the officialdom, so to speak, although I had no title whatsoever, you know, but nevertheless. And again, let's say I wrote a piece that's making fun of how that it took a young man to take a passport 2 months, making fun of the bureaucracy and so on. But I realized from when I was running through my head, Jesus, for them, what idiot would want to have a passport in which you write, fight them, you're Jewish. In other words, you don't want to be seen by the government and so on.
There's a really poignant part of the memoir where you're taking a train back to Odessa after having made it as a satirist. And yeah, you really are questioning these things. And when you finally get to see your family, they don't really seem to mention your work much. And then on the other hand, I think you experience when you get into the world of writing, I mean, when you're first offered the job of being a satirist, you have one official saying to you, well, you're from Odessa, so you can do satire. I mean, all of this must be very strange. It must be very just odd, because you seem to have two sides that don't necessarily understand where you're coming from or saying odd things.
Well, okay. First of all, Odessa, as I explained, it has a reputation of the capital in Russian culture. It was a capital of humor. It was assumed that all jokes are produced in Odessa and then passed from mouth to mouth around the country. So it was assumed that. And obviously, the reason for that is because of the Jewish population, because Jewish humor was part of the vernacular of that time, and there were many words. Actually, I describe it in the book how I had kind of a doubts on that basis because of too much identification of humor with being Jewish. The least of all, I want to be accept, you know, how to say it, to be treat it as a Jew, because I know it's not a win situation at that time for the Soviet Union. So therefore, that's why I was kind of hesitant of, because in Odessa Street, you will see, this is Shmendrik, oh, this is Schmalk. He's, in other words, not only Jews, and Russians as well, because it was part of already the mixing of all culture. Odessa had at one point over 100 nationalities. Actually, Mark Twain, when he traveled back in the 19th century to Odessa, he actually wrote about it. I found it in Innocents Abroad. I came to Odessa, we look left, we look right. There's nothing about Russia. It looks like America. Okay?
So I just had two more questions, and I promise to let you go since we're running up against the hour. The first question I wanted to ask is, did you have any experiences with the KGB? I know a lot of listeners would be interested in hearing about that, and I found some of the stories interesting.
Right. Well, I had three encounters with the KGB on different levels. One, surprisingly, was friendly. It was about a year before I even thought of applying for immigration. And my father-in-law called me and said that one of my customers wants to talk to you. And by itself, it was nothing unusual because I was a freelance satirical writer. So sometimes people call and say, hey, this funny story happened. You should write about it, things like that. But why I was surprised, because he was a tailor who worked in the tailor shop of Ministry of Defense. There is no way any of his clients from Ministry of Defense would want to talk to the press, because nothing about the military to begin with was allowed to be appeared in the press by no means. So I was intrigued, of course. So I called, and it was a very nice man, talk on the phone. He says, invited me to come over. He wants to talk to me. And, you know, if there is no writer without curiosity. You know, I was very curious, and I came to him, and he told me his life story, that he was actually a Soviet spy who worked in the West from 1925 till 1937. And very successful. Then he was recalled and arrested, beaten, tortured, and given 20 years of gulag, and he survived. So he told me the story, and I could not understand why, for God's sake, he's telling me this, because none of it. Now, the year is 1973, I could put in a Soviet paper at all. It was not thinkable about talk about it. So I realized about it only much, much later why he did it, because 25 years later, already in America, I actually found, his name is Bystrolётov, and I found that actually the man was one of the superstar of Soviet espionage of that time. And things were written about him there was a book published at the end of 1990s in America of the shield and the sword and shield, and they revealed this name. And I started digging into it. Obviously, the year is now 2004. I traveled to Moscow. He died a long time ago. Found his grandson. He gave me a lot of his material. I worked in the archives and libraries around the world to find his story. And it was published as a Stalin's Romeo Spy by Norbert University Press. So that was the friendly. The next one was intimidating. As I was about to immigrate, and I describe it in one of my chapter of this book, I wanted to take out my writing, whatever was not published, with me, you know, like part of you. You know, it's hard to throw away something that you over the years you accumulated and so on. It's very, very difficult, part of it. So, but I was told that actually to going through censorship would be impossible, because that would take, will never, they will have out, they will ask you questions. In any word, it was, but they was told that if you go to the Dutch embassy and ask them to put in diplomatic pouches, they will take out of the country, because Dutch embassy at that time handled relationship with Israel, because we all had to leave only officially on Israeli invitation. There was no other way. That was to save the face of the Soviet propaganda. They just wanted to, Jews want to go to their relatives and so on. And then as I was standing in line, a plainclothes KGB man came up to me. Now, obviously, I didn't know this KGB. He started talking to me, and when I didn't feel that anything that I have anti-Soviet so much, and I say some of my writing. Anyway, to make it short, he motioned to the policeman on the post, and they took me out of the line. And for 3 hours, they detained me until KGB man, Lieutenant Kam, came in and started examining what I was saying. Actually, it ended okay because he said, no, you cannot. You have to go through the Glavlit, the censorship bureau, and so on. But then he gave me all back, and I gave it to my brother, who a year later was supposed to go also immigrate. And I told him, when your time will come to come to the embassy, do not talk to anyone. And that's how I eventually got it back, all this. And among these notes were the notes of my conversation with this Soviet spy, Dmitry Bystrolyotov. And now, as a result of the book published, if anyone visits in Washington, D.C., International Spy Museum, on the main floor, there are two big steles of the super spy of all time, Mata Hari and Dmitry Bystrolyotov. Now he's in museum, and I joke to my student, I did not immortalize myself, but immortalize Dmitry Bystrolyotov. He's there. So that's the story.
The very last question I wanted to ask you, and it's sort of a two-part question, is the title In the Jaws of the Crocodile. I guess on the surface, it would seem to be a reference to, you worked at the Crocodile magazine, this satirical magazine. Is there another meaning to that? And also, just in general, what do you hope that readers get out of In the Jaws of the Crocodile? What do you hope they take from it?
Well, I think that although I describe primarily, my work as a satirical writer, but it gives people who never lived in the Soviet Union a sense of life, because I'm not besmearing it without reason. I'm not saying anything glamorous about it as well as is. So that I was pleased, actually, with one of the reviewers when he said that actually you have a good sense of what life is was all about and possibilities of that period of time. But obviously you're right. In the Jaws of Crocodile, it is of course about the magazine Crocodile. But at the same time, made me think of the biblical life of the Job, the story of the Job surviving in the stomach. in that sense, it was not intentional when the publisher came up with this title. But I think in a sense it is. I still came out alive, out of it, and. For better or worse, I made lives here, and I was really lucky in many ways because I made good friends in America. And I never published a book in the Soviet Union, but this is my 16th book in America, and I was able to at least to express myself to the degree that I'm not ashamed to write about the story of my teacher when I was 15, telling me you should try it. You have something. I think I have something.
Well, I think you do as well. And I just wanted to comment. The thing that I really got out of this book was you give a very human face to the experience of someone that would live in the Soviet Union. You give a human face to the citizens that lived in the Soviet Union. And I think that's very important. I think we all need to try to understand each other a lot more and see that we're all human beings in this world together.
That's true. Absolutely true. That's what I'm saying. If everybody would think, I am just a human being, and everybody else is also a human being, many things will be resolved. But unfortunately, sometimes people kind of feel that, no, they're above it. they don't have this shortcomings as other people. They're much, much more chaste, much more better, and so on. But reality, unfortunately, tells us on a daily basis that things again and again prove that you have to be humble in this life.
Well, I want to thank you again, Emil Dreitzer, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Emil Dreitzer, author of In the Jaws of the Crocodile, a Soviet memoir. Please be sure to check out that book if you enjoyed our conversation. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Brian, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.